From WNPR, I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
In the middle of a hurricane, even though it was a Friday evening, I assumed the ratings would be far higher than they would be normally. You know, the hurricane was just starting. And I put it out that I had pardoned, as we say, Sheriff Joe.
Officials predict more than 30,000 people will need temporary shelter as a result of Harvey.
Harvey has already set a record, surpassing 50 inches in some areas.
What began as a presidential tweet is now an official White House memo with profound implications for transgender people.
You're asking for money now when you weren't willing to help the people in the Northeast. What do you have to say to them?
Well, you know, look, there's time for political sniping later. I think our focus
really
needs to be on
sniping,
this crisis,
Senator,
and this disaster.
These are people who needed money and who needed funding right after that storm. I covered those people. Many of them, just like those in Houston, lost absolutely everything they owned.
I don't believe anyone doubts the American people's values or the commitment of the American government or the government's agencies to advancing those values and defending those values.
And the president's values?
The president speaks for himself, Chris.
The president speaks for himself. The truest thing we heard all week in a very busy week of news. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Hey, before I move too much further, I will say that Kyone Wolf, the technical producer of our show and one of the voices of the Colin McEnroe Show told us today is the 8th birthday of the Colin McEnroe Show. So happy birthday,
yeah,
Colin.
I didn't even know that until like 10 minutes ago when she told me.
That's very exciting.
But we're going to celebrate with a raft of fire ants.
Okay.
There's no cake?
It's a tradition.
There's no cake?
No first day of school photo?
We'll come up
the
with
fire
something.
Fire ants eat the cake.
We'll come up with something later on today, but congratulations to Colin and crew. Also with us is Max Reese. He's a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello there, Max.
Hey, good morning, John.
And Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Hello, Christine.
Hello, John.
Well, let's talk about the big news of the day, and of course, it's what's happening in Houston. It's the fourth largest city in America. The governor of the state of Texas has called this one of the largest disasters America has ever faced, and by the numbers, he's absolutely right. More than 40 inches of rain in Houston, about 30,000 people seeking emergency shelter. So many people, 450,000 people likely to seek federal aid. President Trump made a visit there on Tuesday. Here's some of what he had to say.
We have had a tremendous group of folks. Our acting director, Elaine, thank you very much for the job you've done. And a man who's really become very famous on television over the last couple of days, Mr. Long. We appreciate it very much. You have been just outstanding.
There's a lot to talk about, including probably in a couple minutes the response from the federal government and President Trump himself. But first of all, Colin, let's just talk about this again. I will say that it's now the anniversary once again of Katrina. I remember being in the newsroom at NPR in Washington when we first got news of a big hurricane that was heading toward the Gulf Coast in New Orleans, and we saw what happened there. This is seemingly a very different sort of disaster, but it's also of a scale that I don't think we have quite seen before. New Orleans is a big American city. Houston is a huge world city that is almost completely underwater right now.
Right, and you know, we'll be talking over the course of the day today about various kinds of policy decisions that either were or weren't right, ways in which the community could or could not have hardened itself off against stuff like this. But the reality is, for this particular storm, it might not have made that much difference. Houston, because they actually have pretty bad flood control, floods with kind of normal storms. In other words, they had the Tax Day storm in 2016, Memorial Day storm in 2015. These aren't famous storms. You don't know about them. They had big floods then because, in fact, they've got a problem there. They've got a problem there that you don't need a storm of this size to experience. This thing is in its own category. It would have caused trouble even if everybody had been super smart about rain and flood control.
When we talk about the ways in which cities deal with this, we will talk a little bit about resilience and how you plan for a disaster. But what about just the evacuation piece of this? We, of course, have been hearing all throughout the morning on Morning Edition many stories of people who one day were saying, I'm going to stay in place. And then later on that night, they were asking for officials to evacuate them, causing an awful lot of problems. The first responders have been going back time and time again, Colin, to try to get people out of homes where they're trapped.
Right. On the other hand, so people died on the road during Rita. And one of the problems with evacuating, particularly in a place like Houston, well, I mean, this gets a little wonky, but one thing that Houston did, which is actually kind of smart, was they start, once they realized they had a flood control problem, they started installing, as they redid roadbeds, storm sewer systems underneath the roadbeds. And they effectively turned their road system into a water collection apparatus, which, as I say, is not a terrible idea. In certain ways, particularly if you don't have any other way of controlling floods or you're not controlling them very effectively through reservoirs and levees and stuff like that. The problem with it, though, is once those storm systems overload, the water just comes up onto the road and starts rising higher. That's why you see some of the images that you're seeing of trucks and cars with water rising up over them. So at a certain point, it really didn't make sense to tell people to evacuate by car, you know, as the rain was getting closer. And they knew, I think, that this kind of thing. And one thing that we know about Houston, every image that we see of Houston is things happened very fast. The rain was so intense. And because there isn't kind of a dispersal system for water in Houston, it's much more like a catch basin that just sort of accumulates water really fast without having any place to put it. Things happen even faster. So, usually I look at this and there are all these people trapped and I think, well, I don't know. I was hearing news reports 2 days ago. I would have gotten out. Why didn't you get out? Here, it may have made more sense for people to shelter in place, even though there are terrible consequences from that.
And there was an interest. I saw an interview with the head of the Texas National Guard talking about why Houston didn't evacuate. And they talked about those older storms. They talked about Rita, talked about other tropical storms and depression that came through the area. And it's fascinating with some of the logic here where Colin's exactly right. People drowned in their cars on the highways. So that says to people, well, if I leave, I might drown in my car on the highway. However, what the National Guard was saying was, yeah, that's true, but that was a poorly handled evacuation anyway. And they were saying, don't justify one bad decision with another bad decision. That was one of the things they were saying. In other words, saying they think they could have gotten other people out. However, how do you justify that when people know that there were really bad consequences the last time there was a major storm, whether it was the Memorial Day storm, the Tax Day storm, any of those?
And I think that there are people, I have friends down there right now who, decided to stay in place and things were fine for day one and day two. And then all of a sudden, you know, day three comes and they're like, wow, this water is really high. But at that point, if you try to evacuate, There's nowhere for you to go at this point. You know, you're lucky if there is a gas station or a convenience store that you can get to that's still open where you're able to get food and stuff like that.
Well, part of the problem for people like that, too, there are a lot of people there who kind of reasonably thought they didn't live in a floodplain because they lived there for 30 years in the same location. They've never been in a floodplain. But as development changes drainage patterns, mm-hmm. Every 5 years, things are real. Maybe even every 2 years, things are different in Houston. Water goes to places that it's never gone before. So yeah, you had these people sitting there in their houses that have never flooded before, and they like opened the door and water would come pouring in.
And that's a lot of what happened. I mean, Houston has been enormously developed over the past few years, and I don't think that the flood maps have kept up with that.
And I was going to make 2 points. A dear friend of mine lives in Buffalo Bayou, and her father drove to pick her up saying, oh, no, we're never going to flood out where we live. And the water came right up to their front doorstep. Mm-hmm. Their home did not flood. But that was the logic. The logic was I can get there and we'll be fine. And she posts on Facebook, yeah, we're fine, but we still should have left as a just in case. But secondly, that's a great point about the way development has happened. How do you say to a developer, a once in a lifetime storm might happen in 3 or 4 years, so you shouldn't put this strip mall here? And they say, yeah, but that's a once-in-a-lifetime storm. Why wouldn't we? That's a one-time event. That's not a big deal.
Well, I think in just a little bit we're going to come back to some of that because I think it does relate to the way in which a state like Connecticut or all up and down the East Coast, we think about building and growth and resiliency. I will, though, go to something political, and we heard of it at the top of the program, Christine. You know, Ted Cruz there taking a little bit of heat from Katie Turr on MSNBC about how he and many other congresspeople voted down Sandy aid at the time that the Northeast needed it. Now, in part, what Senator Cruz and others said is they didn't like the bill that had what they called an awful lot of pork not related to rebuilding. Of course, he's now asking for quite a bit of aid from the federal government, rightly, for Houston. I'm wondering a little bit about the politics of this because while Sandy, as an event, wasn't as localized as what happened in Houston, and it wasn't as devastating in some ways, it caused an awful lot of damage on a very large swath of the most populated part of our country.
It definitely did. And I think that the final bill, you know, there may have been earlier iterations that had what you could call pork in it. But the final bill that went into effect did not have what you would call pork in it. You know, so the final bill that he would have voted against was aid to Northeast homeowners.
Yeah. Go ahead, Max.
No, there's so much political hypocrisy with all these things, right? Like, you know, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn were the ones saying, well, if you're going to pass a Sandy relief bill, you have to offset that with commensurate spending cuts. So if you're going to put $20 billion towards Sandy relief, I got to see $20 billion in spending cuts. That all sounds well and good, and that's great for your constituency. I'm sure that sold very well. I would even bet in the Houston suburbs and Katy, Texas, and part of Corpus Christi. But good luck saying that to people in New Jersey, people in Staten Island. You know, they were saying, guys, this isn't about spending right now. This is about what we how we respond to this.
Well, and there's only one in six people in Houston, I'm told, that has flood insurance. And if you don't have flood insurance, your homeowner's insurance is not going to cover any of the damage
right.
from what has resulted. So there's going to have to be some sort of federal government help.
I mean, ultimately, we're going to have a come-to-Jesus conversation about all this stuff because this is not an isolated instance because of climate change. Storms are getting worse and more intense. And meanwhile, I mean, you have this sort of 1-2 punch, overdevelopment in coastal areas and climate change, and they have a multiplier effect on each other. So Forbes every year does the fastest-growing communities in the U.S. For 2017, 4 of the 5 are in coastal Florida. 8 of the 15, for top 15, are in coastal Florida. All of these places are incredibly storm prone. They're growing fast. They're developing fast. They're not developing with resilience built into them. Noisily on August 15th, the famous Trump Tower press conference where he kind of went nuts about Charlottesville. It was sort of his third iteration of his Charlottesville comments. So that's what everybody remembers. He was standing there with Elaine Chao. One of the things they were talking about is ripping out an Obama provision that required sort of climate change related resilience to be a factor in infrastructure development, in particularly in areas like this that are flood prone. We're going to have a much more serious and thoughtful conversation about this because it's going to get, among other things, very expensive in addition to being dangerous.
Well, and it's much more expensive to come to flood planning after the fact. So it's so much easier that if you start with the mentality that this could flood at some point, we're going to build it so it is flood proof. Is way cheaper than doing it after the
fact. And Mother Nature has an interesting way of timing these kinds of megastorms because as we speak, we are in the middle of a federal budget debate and the federal flood insurance program runs out of money at the end of September. And if you're a lawmaker from Texas, and obviously not all of them voted against Sandy relief. I don't know about obvious, but a large handful did not vote against Sandy relief. But you better believe that they're going to have constituents saying you better fund this flood insurance program because we are a state that desperately needs it.
Well, the first thing they're also going to have to think about is, I mean, one thing that makes this similar and different to and from Sandy is the economic piece of this. So Houston is a different kind of an economic piece of the American puzzle because of all the refineries and stuff like that around there. But I mean, you're talking about a sector of the American economy taking a huge hit. Sandy hit a different sector of the American economy. But, I mean, there'll be, a limited amount of space for political fooling around about this because the ripple effect on the economy of just, like, leaving this fourth largest city in the United States festering would be significant.
Well, let's stay with this topic for a bit, and we'll swoop back around to the week that Donald Trump had, including this event. But I mean, it's one of the things that we wanted to talk about today, Colin, is when we think about events like this. You mentioned already the kind of unchecked growth in places like South Florida that are prone to large storms like this along the Gulf Coast. As Christine said, Houston has exploded in size. I mean, we've looked at maps in the past where if you put the actual city of Houston over top of the map of Connecticut, it would blot it all out. Houston is basically as big as most of Connecticut is, and that means an awful lot of impervious surfaces. It means very wide highways. It means parking lots. It means strip malls. Here in Connecticut, we have this other problem, this gigantic budget deficit, and we have people saying that we're not business friendly enough, that businesses leave Connecticut for the pastures of Florida or Texas, where taxes are different and companies are more welcomed. But Connecticut seems in some ways, Colin, to have an advantage over some of those places in terms of the ability to be resilient to the very thing that we're talking about, climate change, sea level rise, and increasingly large storms that are going to be coming year after year.
Yeah, and there's so many pieces to this. First of all, and I know you'll join me in this, everybody should read the multi-part series that was done by the Texas Trib and ProPublica. It involved one of our former staffers, Nina Satija, journalist from the future. And it's really terrific. And it's about how Houston got to be Houston. And one thing about Houston, like when you think about a city, don't think about New York when you think about Houston. Houston's a much more spread out city. There isn't a kind of dense packing in a lot of Houston. So that's one of the reasons that it's geographically so big and could slide over Connecticut. Nonetheless, what they did there was eliminated a lot of prairie. That's what they had. They had coastal prairie. Coastal prairie could absorb water. There's prairie grass in it. These are all really good things, except when you don't have them anymore. And then once again, yeah, you have impermeable surfaces. The water has to find someplace else to go. And what ProPublica and the Texas Trib found is that developers just won these arguments every single time because it's such a business-friendly climate that scientists and engineers are standing there going, no, you can't do this. And you really also have to start engineering for climate change because these storms are going to get bigger and more frequent. One thing I'll just momentarily clear up because people get it wrong all the time, including, I might add, the President of the United States. When we talk about a 500-year storm or 100-year storm, it's not a storm that occurs once every 500 years. I mean, when you think about it, we don't really know what kind of storms there were in 1517 in the United States.
They dressed very well, those
guys. Right, yes. So it's like, you know, that's not what it means. It's basically, these are like casino odds, basically. They're saying there's a 1 in 500 chance that a storm like this will hit in any given year. And what's happened is, I don't know if I can explain this properly, but it's sort of like a casino that has the odds wrong, right? If Mohegan Sun and Fox Woods said that there's a 500-to-1 chance against something happening, and it happened much more frequently than that, if it happened 30 out of every 500 times, pretty soon that would start costing the casino money. The problem in places like Houston is the people setting the odds and the people paying off on the losses are not the same people. So the people who are setting those odds, they've got the odds wrong. A 500-year storm isn't really a 1 in 500 chance anymore. We now know that. And certainly a 100-year storm is no longer a 1 in 100-year chance of happening. So you've got those odds, but the people who are the house, the people who pay, are essentially, when you get down to it, us. So the bad planning, we pay for the bad planning.
And we pay for the bad planning, whether or not it happens locally or whether or not it happens in Houston. As we've said, it's such a big part of the economy. And of course, with the oil refineries, we're all going to see it at the gas pump. But I guess I'm just wondering, Christine, about the conversations post-Sandy as we look at the way in which Connecticut builds. I mean, there is some reluctance to tell people who have your shoreline homes to retreat a little bit from the shoreline. But we do have a very different way of planning here than we do, say, in Houston or South Florida. And I guess I'm just wondering if that's ever going to be seen as a positive in Connecticut, as opposed to a business-unfriendly climate that sends people away.
You know, I hope it is. I think that there were a lot of people who rebuilt on the Connecticut coast after Sandy. And I think that they did it in a responsible way that kind of took into consideration climate change. And I think that there's an acknowledgement in Connecticut that climate change is real. I think that the Tropical Storm Irene, I think the 2011, the freak snowstorm we had in October that put everybody's power out, I think that they are planning for this. I think we've cut down a lot of trees in the past few years. And hopefully it will draw people to Connecticut as a state that is seen as, you know, prosperous and a place you can grow.
Yeah. And another thing, Max, that we see in this area just within the last week or so, buried amongst all this other news, the states of New England, as well as others in the Northeast, come back together on a regional greenhouse gas initiative plan that from 2021 to 2030 is going to cut even more in the carbon emissions that are coming out of this area. This is an area that seems to not only say climate change is real and happening, but it's something that we've got got to do something about here. And more states around the country are looking at this and saying, maybe this is part of a resiliency plan for the future.
This is a regional initiative. I mean, it is obvious that what's going on in the Northeast, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Vermont, Maine, all these states obviously believe that climate change is happening. And they're saying, if we band together as a group, right, the 10 million, the 12 million, 50 million people that live in the region, we can make this difference up here. The question is, what do you do with a state like Texas or Oklahoma, where there are maybe the greenhouse gas issue isn't nearly as settled, I guess probably be the word, that it is settled. Getting back to the point about making Connecticut a selling point, the fact that we are maybe a little more prepared than other states when it comes to climate change, I don't know if we're going to see that on a Newsweek list anytime soon, the ones that get shared on Twitter and on Facebook and on social media. You're the ones that consistently slam Connecticut. But I will say the state does a pretty good job removing snow every time there's a major snow event. And all these things are still connected.
We don't have mudslides. We don't have wildfires. We don't have a lot of things that happen in areas where there's
a 1 acre wildfire in New Hartford like a year ago.
Yeah, right. I actually remember that one. But we don't have the kinds of problems that you have as much anyway from overdevelopment in other areas. Of course, the problem, there's sort of two kinds of ways in which climate change affects us. One is resilience. So resilience is a different kind of conversation in some ways. It doesn't have so much to do with cutting our carbon emissions and contributing less to the overarching factors that create climate change. But Patrick Scahill has a story today where property owners along the coast were interviewed about their attitudes towards marsh migration. Marsh migration would be something that actually would take too long to explain it right here, but that might be connected to resilience in cases of coastal flooding. And it turns out homeowners were really nervous about giving conservation easements and stuff like that. Now, that just could be because the education program hasn't happened yet. They don't really quite understand what's being discussed. They don't understand what would happen to their property in these situations. So it's not as though we don't have any work to do. We do have work to do. We have a coastline. It is going to be affected, particularly as polar ice gets melted and gets in the water. It may be affected very quickly. So there's work to be done. But I think in some ways we have a healthier, sounder infrastructure that's less affected by these catastrophic events.
Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Max Reese is a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Christine Stewart is editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. When we come back, we'll talk more about the week's news, including the week that Donald Trump had. Harvey overshadowed an awful a lot of other things that happened with the president. We're also going to turn to the state budget and find out what's happening in Hartford. Coming up next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Christine Stewart. She's the editor-in-chief of ctnewsjunkie.com. Max Reese is political reporter for NBC Connecticut. And Colin McEnroe hosts The Colin McEnroe Show, celebrating its 8th birthday today. Very excited about that. What's on the show today, Colin?
We actually didn't know it was our 8th birthday. What we're going to do today is we're going to re-air a show about walls. This show was done before we knew that zombie dragons can melt ice walls, so that will not be in the show.
Spoiler alert!
But other than that, I think it will be a very complete show about walls. The reason we're doing that is that tonight we'll be at the Copper Beach Institute, which is on the grounds of the Holy Family Monastery in West Hartford. We're going to be doing a show about music and spirituality. One of John's favorite musicians, Noah Behrman, will be part of the lineup. We have great musicians. We're going to talk. They're going to play. The audience is going to sing, and we'll come out of this calmer than we went in, which we all need.
Very nice. Sing along with the Colin McEnroe Show tonight. That should be a lot of fun. Let's get back to some of the news of the week, and we'll start back in Houston again with Donald Trump. We played a little bit of tape at the start. Of course, he made the decision to go with his wife Melania down to Houston. Obviously, there were some people calling on him to go and see what was happening. Other people were saying, "Please stay away," not because of anything other than they've got a huge logistical problem, and sometimes having the president there makes things a little bit more difficult. What did you see out of the president in Texas, Colin?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's hard to know from our perspective how this plays in Texas. I thought that he wrong-footed almost everything. He's very good at the sort of chin-up, we'll get through this part, or he's sort of good at that anyway. But, I mean, he's not very good at the empathy part. This started on Sunday when, you know, the waters are rising, and he's tweeting a little bit about, wow, this is really one heck of a storm, exclamation point. But he's also tweeting, I mean, he's trash-talking Claire McCaskill, and he's promoting Sheriff Clark's book, and he's, like, doing a lot of stuff that you really wouldn't be doing if you were totally focused on an unfolding crisis, you know, and from there, it's, you know, there are little things like Melania's snakeskin stiletto heels, typically not what you wear when you visit the site of a disaster. The way that he crowed about great turnout there as though he's still basically reading every situation in terms of what kind of affirmation of him it represents. You know, all those things are troubling. To me, the most troubling thing, I mean, this is just like, I feel weird talking about this because Houston is so important and so dire and so big. But the guy standing there wearing a cap that says USA, which is for sale on his campaign website for $40. Here he is, a president visiting the scene of a disaster, and he cannot stop himself from QVCing this particular moment. You know, I just find this, I mean, maybe it played great in Texas, maybe it was fine, but I was just horrified by that.
So, because you can't make this stuff up, folks, we've been on the air since 9:04 and 30 seconds.
Something like that, yes.
I'm afraid.
So there have been two tweets in that time by the president, and I know we're going to get to part of this later, but this is part of the danger of what some of the social media that comes out of the president directly is part of. His first tweet says, after witnessing firsthand the horror and devastation caused by Hurricane Harvey, my heart goes out even more so to the great people of Texas. 15 minutes later, he then says, after reading the false reporting and even ferocious anger in some dying magazines, it makes me wonder why all I want to do is make America great again. You can't talk about the horror of Harvey and then talk about fake news. You can't do that. Those two are not, they are connected. You can't do that. What happened in Harvey was real. The reporters that were there were doing real things. They were in the water. They were seeing death and destruction to the likes of which we probably really have never seen before. You can't have the president of the United States say fake news because there's one magazine article, I'm guessing it's Newsweek or Time or something, that he doesn't like. That's not how this works.
Yeah, I think it's a New York Times magazine piece, I think, because I just saw something on MSNBC.
The failing New York Times.
That's right. There you go, yeah. And that's probably what it is.
Yeah, I don't understand how yesterday he went down there and, you know, he was trying not to be congratulatory of the efforts, but then he was congratulatory of the efforts and then showed absolutely no empathy whatsoever for the victims of this.
The empathy piece of it is clearly difficult for the president, and it's probably the thing that people need to hear the most. But I think, as Colin said before, his natural default is the chin up, we'll get through this piece of it. And he spent a little bit of time down there doing some of that.
But also the way he talks about the storm almost sounds like a campaign audience. Mm-hmm. He says this is the biggest, it's the most incredible, the most epic storm. Almost as if to say, can you believe this happened on my watch? Like, lucky me, I get to deal with this because I'm such a great president that I'm the one. Thank God I'm here, in other words, that I'm the one who can save you from this storm.
And maybe that'll play with certain people,
too. It might, absolutely.
You know, the history of presidents and disasters, the history of leaders and storms, very complicated. Here in Connecticut, I will now be a boring old person for a second. Here in Connecticut, Abraham Ribicoff became the most impervious politician in the history of Connecticut because of how he handled floods. He went to the scenes of floods. He had this hat on. I mean, he looked like Moses or something. Like, afterwards, you just couldn't touch Ribicoff. Grasso, of course, famously in 78, that storm where she closed the roads and I don't know, she was up in helicopters looking at stuff. But if you do this right, you know, if you handle a situation like this right, you can become the kind of leader that people never forget. It's tougher with presidents. You have so many different constituencies. People tend to nitpick what you do or read it differently. Of course, George W. Bush in Katrina wrong-footed a couple of things and maybe made a decision that in retrospect, given some of the stuff that you were saying, John, about, like, you know, do you create an operational hazard by showing up there? So he did the flyover, got in a lot of trouble for that. You're doing a great job, Brownie. He'll never forget that. It's easy to mess this stuff up. Maybe people will like the kind of triumphalism that Trump does.
Well, and I guess I'll just say it's easy to mess this stuff up. And for as much as we might be able to say about the president stepping out on the wrong foot about any one given thing, Christine, this is a very hard one to win. You don't necessarily win this moment because you can't go down there and pull right. people out of buildings yourself. If you fly over, it looks bad. If you go there, it looks bad. If you say one thing, it looks bad. And so it probably is hard to judge Donald Trump too much on this piece of it. I will say, to get back to something that I'd wanted to talk about that Max kind of raised with these tweets, it's about the role of journalists in this storm and their relationship with the president. So we've got this theme going across America, which is that journalists are some of the worst people. Yes. And it's not just Donald Trump saying this, but it's an awful lot of people believing it. And as we've talked about on the show before, some people feeling very threatened personally by the actions and the words of others towards journalists. Then we see during this storm, journalists acting, you know, heroically in many cases, helping people in danger. I guess I'm just wondering about that view from a journalist standpoint of someone who is covering an event and you're also getting involved in an event where people are in danger. And there's this overlay of people looking at you going, oh, here's a journalist again, and we know what they're going to do. It's just been an interesting thing to watch this week, I think.
Yeah, I think that there's conflicting trains of thoughts regarding how journalists should act in these situations. There are some journalists who say that you should not become part of a story and that you should strictly stay out of the story and not help out and not be in any way aiding and abetting any sort of rescue efforts. And then there are others who say that, you know, if this happens, how could you not react and how could you not act as a human being to some of what is happening down there? So I actually have this recurring nightmare. I guess I call it a nightmare, that a plane crashes in front of me, and I don't know whether to run and get my camera or to go save the people. Mm-hmm. And I believe that I would probably go save the people in the plane crash and not grab my camera. And I don't know if that makes me bad or good.
Well, but it's,
you know, so I.
And it's an interesting quandary. And I'll say, you know, when we watched Hurricane Katrina, Max, there were so many of these stories in which it felt as though CNN and some of the other networks were using their reporters as these kind of superheroes who are going out looking for someone to save because it really helps ratings. At the same point, if you see somebody drowning, you want to help them first and you want to take pictures later, probably.
I think that it's you have to be so careful about the way you're covering the storm. I mean, you know, first of all, I've only been in mainly winter storms with my Cabela's coveralls we talked about over email.
Yeah, and, no, we wanted to bring on Max because we need to have one television reporter who is studied at standing in the rain with bad-looking rain gear
I have three NBC Connecticut hats I use in rotation to keep them dry. No, but look, the cable networks, that's one thing. They kind of are looking for the show. But some of the good examples of what happened in Houston are really some of the best examples. Like KHOU, one of the affiliates down there, their newsroom literally had water flowing into it. Mm-hmm. And they had to move their entire live operation. So what did that leave? That left one reporter out in the field for a half an hour, which everybody in this room knows that's a really hard thing to do. Be on air for a half an hour without stopping, no script. And the cable networks, they're some of my brethren in this business, right? But at the end of the day, it's entertainment and it's a show. But it's the local news, whether it's a local NPR station or local NBC or a CBS or if ABC or Fox affiliate or whatever, they're the ones who are getting those redeeming stories out of the storm that make it almost palatable to talk about. Mm-hmm. Because you know there's death, you know there's destruction, but some of the best stories come out of that.
And I will say some of my very best friends in the business are there right now covering this for NPR. And this also all happened in the week, Colin, that we saw another story with another NPR friend, Al Letson, the host of the investigative program Reveal, who stepped in during one of these rallies in Berkeley. There was a kind of a neo-Nazi rally, and some Antifa protesters ran in and were clearly beating up a guy who was one of the alt-right. Al Letson, wearing his gear, his headphones, and his microphone, as we all do when we stand out in the field, actually put himself between the man who was being beaten and the attackers. And he's drawn some notoriety for that. I'm just wondering about how that all plays into, again, this question of, on one hand, you know, the reporter's ethics. On the other hand, you know, this this worry that we have coming out of the president that we're some of the worst people in America.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just to go back to some of the stuff that we've been talking about here, one thing that you know is that whether it was Katrina or now, the people who are being affected by this want it to be covered. They appreciate the efforts of reporters who often do put themselves at considerable risk to cover these stories. But tell our story. We need the world to know what kind of trouble we're in right now is a frequent refrain in situations like this or Syria or you name it. Tell our story is really important. In terms of how reporters act, I don't know. To me, this isn't all that complicated. It really is. What kind of world do you want to live in? And if you're, John Rawls, the philosopher, talks about these thought experiments where you design the world you want to live in without knowing exactly what role or job or status you'll have in it. And then live as though you were in that world. Well, personally, I would like to be in a world where, as a journalist, if I got into a lot of trouble and people were about to beat me up, somebody would come save me, or if I were about to slide into the water, somebody would come save me. So if I want to live in that world, then as a journalist, I should act as though I'm in that world. I should act to save other people.
And to dovetail slightly, as some of you said, John, earlier about, and then to your point, Christine, also about the plane crashed in front of you. What do? You grab the camera. Do you help? There are tiny examples all the time that everybody does, journalist or not, during these situations that you don't even think about. And I'm not even speaking for me. I'm speaking for my friends. And this gets to your point earlier that journalists are horrible, despicable, awful human beings. The number of times where we're driving in downtown Hartford or Willimantic or wherever it is during a severe winter storm, and we say, hey, do you want to borrow our ice scraper? Hey, we have some salt. Do you want this? That's not us marketing NBC Connecticut. That's saying, hey, we're driving around in this awful weather. We probably need some help eventually. We're just trying to pay it forward a little bit.
Well, and I think that's what people forget, too. I think that specifically in the 2011 ice storm, people forget that you as a reporter and a journalist are also living without power and without electricity. And so you're, in addition to doing your job, you're also trying to survive on the other end. And I think that I had a friend who had an independent website in New York, Sheephead Bites, and his house in Sandy was completely gone, completely destroyed, flooded. But he continued to do his work to make sure that people had connections to the outside world and were able to get news about their community. And it's hard.
I will say, I think that the experience that we're all living through after that 2011 storm led to some of those fairly grumpy press conferences that we covered with the governor in Connecticut Light and Power, in which everyone was kind of couple days old, stinky, no one had eaten really well, and yep. Everyone was there asking questions about why my power's not back on. Before we go to break, we got a tweet from Senator Gary Winfield who says, it may play with some, but my sister who lives there has lost so much. We don't want triumph. We want empathy and thoughtfulness. You can, of course, join us on Twitter at The Wheelhouse. There's a lot more to talk about here. Let's take a break. We're going to come back with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, Max Rees from NBC Connecticut, and our own Colin McEnroe. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Max Rees from NBC Connecticut, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show here at WNPR. It's the first day of school all across Connecticut, or at least in a lot of districts. And, of course, we're going back to school with no state budget in place. We've talked about this a little bit, Christine, but it's having a big impact on school districts around the state. And I guess I'm just wondering what we should be thinking about as kids go back to school in a very uncertain time.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think kids are going to be going back to school and that classrooms are going to be a little bit more crowded. There's going to be a few fewer teachers in the school, maybe fewer paraprofessionals in the school, and that, there might be a few less books than they had in the past, and it's not going to be easy. And if they decide not to pass a budget until the week of September 11th, there's still a lot of uncertainty. So the governor's threat to take away education funding from 85 communities doesn't go into effect until October 1st. So if they can pass a budget and figure out where they land in this budget process, that they can basically save the school year probably for a bunch of communities.
My drive into work, Max, takes me past a home that has a gigantic banner out front that says, Governor Malloy, stay away from our schools. It's there in part because it's also on the governor's running route every morning where he takes his 2.5-mile jog around Elizabeth Park.
Yeah, and you know, this is, I mean, pick your really morbid example. Is it a gun to the head or is it a knife to the throat of all these different school systems? But in a lot of ways, the governor, politically speaking, has put his chips on the table and said, this is what I'm going to do. And I think that there's a ripple effect consequence if that money doesn't get out, because then if October 1st comes, those payments don't happen, the sky doesn't fall, and then those school systems that Christine said have maybe a couple more kids in the classroom, fewer paraprofessionals, maybe fewer supplies, but the world is still here, then Governor Malloy gets to stand there and say, you see, we didn't spend that money and everything's going to be okay. But that's really not what those cities and towns want to hear.
Yeah, my guess is that this becomes a gigantic political problem if they don't solve it right now. I mean, it's already a gigantic political problem. But, I mean, the ripple effect from not having a budget has affected a lot of other people, too, people in what I keep calling vulnerable populations. Yeah. But they're a smaller subset of the electorate. Almost everybody knows a kid who goes to school, and their parents do a lot of voting. And it just seems to me that if they don't solve this problem – it's not a political problem for Governor Malloy. His political career is
over.
It's in lame duck status. Yeah. So it's a political problem for everybody in the legislature who has any kind of fingerprint on this. And I don't think you're going to be able to play a partisan game here. In other words, I don't think you as a Republican can say, oh, no, it's their fault. I think everybody's going to get blamed for this.
Yeah. And essentially, you know, the governor's budget, his executive order, in addition to his budget proposal that shifts the teacher pension cost, basically would cause communities to raise the property tax. So the Democratic budget proposes raising the sales tax. So we basically are fighting over which revenue stream to raise and which is, you know, both of them are regressive.
But it also seems likely that over time, given, you know, as we had Keith Faniff on the other week talking about the gigantic hole we're in and keep beating that drum for everyone, the fact is it's probably both of those revenue streams and some sort of income taxes over the course of time are all going to be raised. It's not as though we're right. choosing now, Christine, but we're going to have tax increases probably on sales, definitely on property taxes, and probably also down the road in income taxes as well.
Yeah, no, we definitely are. I mean, we have not looked and changed our tax structure to account for the new economy. We have developed and we have more taxes on goods than we have on services, even though we're a service-based economy. So, you know, how we look at our tax structure in the future is going to be a big political debate.
It's something I'll say, too, and you know, I know once I leave this building, I'll get yelled at for saying this, but no one is seriously talking about cutting spending. There's no serious conversation about it. I mean, you hear things like, all right, we need a bonding cap. Okay, we need to have a cap on our overall spending, a constitutional spending cap. Okay, that's fine. You're still spending a whole lot of money.
Well, what happened was that we didn't bond money for a DeLorean so that we could go back in
time
and fund the pensions.
That's
so
right.
We wouldn't spend the extra
right.
money we thought we had, but oops, we really don't have that money.
And the Democrats, they want to keep spending money. The Republicans are saying, well, we have to keep spending money exactly the way so we keep all of our cities and towns whole. Mm-hmm. And you know, and the governor, even though he still wants to raise taxes in kind of a roundabout way that Keith Faniff has described, you know, there's as much of a spending problem, I think, as there is a revenue problem in different respects, depending on your perspective. But, this state is in gigantic trouble, not just this year, for 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah, well, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And so there really isn't a sector of spending right now that self-identifies anyway as being cuttable. And there's been a fair amount of cutting already to a lot of those sectors. Just back to what Christine said, she's absolutely right. You're absolutely right. We need some kind of holistic look at how our process of raising revenue maps onto the current state of the economy. I don't think we're going to get that. I mean, what they tend to do is fiddle with the dials, right? Turn one up to 11, one up to 13, and one down to 7 or something, and just hope somehow or other that by remixing the tax system that they're going to get a better album. You know, they put a little bit more cowbell in there.
Well, actually, you know, and throw this into the mix as far as the thought process is concerned. How many homes have crumbling foundations?
Absolutely.
That if we don't fix that problem, which is going to create a huge problem for the housing market just in general, what happens if we lose 10,000 homes in Connecticut pretty much overnight.
And the Crumbling Foundations issue is as much an economic development project as it is anything else. I mean, there's you want to talk about golden political opportunity to have some kind of a silver lining to this, or golden lining would be a better vernacular there. You know, you have an opportunity to save the value of millions upon millions of dollars of homes. And the Democrat plan, they're saying there's a plan in there. We've got to see what the language exactly looks like on it. But, you know, that's another big one.
We started this talking about back to school, Tom. I will say maybe a little bit of a positive story here. Back to school in downtown Hartford, Colin, a new UConn campus opens. I will say on this program, I was somewhat critical of the decision to plan the new UConn downtown campus right in the heart of what was becoming on Front Street a burgeoning commercial district, wondering why we're going to put more non-taxable land right down there. But it does seem as though bringing some students and foot traffic into that area in what looks like a pretty nice new building might be a good thing for downtown Hartford. What do you see in the new UConn downtown?
Right. I crabbed about the same thing, I will confess. So on Friday night, I parked my car kind of by the old Hartford Times building, and I just went for a walk. And I walked down to the riverfront. I walked up onto the bridge that goes over the highway and the river, where I would point out in this time of very politically fraught statues, there are all these Lincoln statues that Lincoln Financial put out there, but they're all very abstract, and they're about unity and the ability of people to rise from the depths, and they're very inspiring as opposed to divisive. And then, yes, walking around this area where the new UConn Hartford is going to be, it really is walking around there, I kept thinking, this looks like this incredibly affluent area. I mean, in terms of infrastructure, in terms of what's there, the only thing missing are people. It was a beautiful Friday evening, and there just weren't all that many people. There were some people sitting out in some of the patios along the Front Street restaurants and stuff. And so if it puts people in there, I mean, really this, you think you go there and then you go to Springfield. Hartford is a much more beautiful downtown than Springfield. It has much less of what you would call blight in its downtown area anyway. All it really needs are people. And there's been like this 30-year effort in my lifetime just to get people to be there. And if maybe this one works.
I would say actually that was I came from the Chicago area out to Connecticut back in 1996, and that was my first impression of Hartford. I was like, this is a great city. What would it take to get some people here? That's all it needs is a few people.
And you know, getting those people there, Max, of course, is always a challenge. Something else I experienced for the first time last night. I made it through the entire year without going to a Hartford Yard Goats game, and I was there. I was busy. There was a lot going on, but I really wanted to see it. And the stadium is quite beautiful, notwithstanding the way in which the stadium was built. The stadium is quite beautiful, and it was filled with people having a good time and walking around outside as well.
So it's a funny thing about the stadium, right? Like it's one of these things. I will say this: I spent more time in that paperweight of a stadium that it was before it became a stadium, I think, than most other reporters, just because I was there kind of every day. I actually saw the owner at a game the other day, Josh Solomon, and he looks out facetiously and goes, "No one's going to come. No one's going to come." It was a sold out night, like on a Tuesday night. And is the idea of the minor league team great? Of course it is. Absolutely. And it was all, I personally thought it was always going to succeed. It has succeeded, but to your point, the roadmap of getting there was rocky and pretty awful, if you're really going to get editorial about it. But those games make Hartford a really cool place to be. Mm-hmm. Every single night there's a game going on. And that's a fact. That's not even an opinion.
So I guess I wonder, Colin, what does it take then to get beyond having a UConn campus with students who are going to spend some time and hopefully some money down there to get the people on the street that help to make this great city that Christine calls it a place where there's a little bit more vibrancy, too?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had the magic wand for that. I mean, having people live there really helps a lot. I think one of the problems that we're going to always have is that this particular state and this particular part of this particular state has a very sort of bedroom community, suburban orientation. I keep coming back to the fact that the little restaurant that's right next to the enormous hulking Aetna can't stay open, right? Why can't it stay open? Because people don't stick around and eat there. They go home. They go back to Simsbury or Avon or Glastonbury or wherever it is that they live. And I don't think you'll change that. I think that's a really hard thing to change. I think the way that you really help Hartford the most is get people to live in Hartford.
And also, at the end of the day, one of the issues that plays into that, it's a government city as well. You have an entire population of people that work and end at 5 p.m., and that's the same for just about every state capital in America. But you got to come up with ways to fight that.
Well, and our transportation, too. You know, we're a car city for the most part. So,
well, we'll keep working on all that stuff, and maybe we'll solve it over the course of time on these Wednesdays with Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Thanks so much, Christine.
Thanks, John.
Thanks to Max Reese, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Thank you, Max.
Thank you, John.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
Thanks to our technical producer, Kyone Wolf, our digital editor, Heather Brandon, and the executive producer, Katie Talarski. They're also the people who helped to put on The Colin McEnroe Show, celebrating 8 years on WNPR today. Congratulations to The Colin McEnroe Show. You can find us at WNPR.org. I'm John Dankowski. Thanks for joining us.